Welcome, day one, getting kicked off. What was your name again, Greg? Gary was the first one here before anyone else. He's stoked because almost all of his sessions are in this room. So that's awesome that you're here. Thank you very much for coming out. In case you haven't already detected by my accent, I'm Rick Claus. I'm a senior IT pro evangelist out of Canada. And I'm down here in the Gold Coast to talk to you guys about a bunch of different things. And this morning's talk is going to be about iSCSI and iSCSI performance. And I can say I'm very excited to be here. I've never been down this neck of the woods, this far south, this long haul before. It's been a great time so far. But, you know, when I say that I'm Canadian, I get a couple of preconceived notions that come up a little bit about what I'm like and what Canada's like. And so I thought I'd share a couple little observations that I had. I was at Tech Ed New Zealand last week and had my introduction for the very first time to some stuff. But one thing I noticed is that as Commonwealth countries, we have way better looking money than the United States, because Canada also has lovely, colorful money, which I enjoy, and always have to deal with the United States people kind of saying, hey, that's Monopoly money, that's play money. It's like, no, dude, this is real stuff. It's more colorful, it's an artwork. I like your money because it's high tech. I just found out you can't even rip your money because it's made out of plastic or something like that. And it's designed for people that get it wet and don't have to worry about it getting destroyed, stuff like that. Kind of cool from a perspective of that. But there's nothing that we have in common, too. We have a national religion as well. It's called hockey. Down here, you guys also have a national religion as well. It's called rugby. And I've never seen a rugby match before. Oh, you know what? This is the wrong slide. This is the slide I'm supposed to show of rugby. I had the beautiful opportunity of seeing my very first match. I was told it was a union game, right? It wasn't league. And it was the All Blacks versus the Wallabies and Wallaby home soil, the end of the Tri-Nations Cup. I got my ticket online. I went to go see it. I was very happy and excited. I was so excited, I went off and I bought a jersey. So I thought I'd share my jersey here with you. Now, I realized that I made the wrong choice for the jersey, in case you didn't see that particular score. So congratulations on winning the cup. So in homage to the Wallabies, you'll notice I have to maintain my speaker shirt. And so there's my speaker shirt, a little patch in the back. But I'm looking forward to this, and I'm looking forward to seeing you guys play your match. And then someone told me after my session in New Zealand, you know, Canada's got a rugby team. How come you're not supporting Canada in rugby? And I'm like, good point. So I did a little bit of research, and I came back with the rankings. And you can see here, Canada's number 14th. We're not last. And apparently, we're also over here playing. And then obviously, you know, there's Australia, and then there's Canada. The best thing we have in common, though, we're beating the United States. That's the most important part. So I said, okay, well, let's dig up and actually find out what it was like with Canadians playing Australians and Canadians playing New Zealands with rugby. And then I found these particular stats for New Zealand. They absolutely trounced us with 234 points. The most we ever got was 9 points in one game, I think. And then similar stats, but I will give you guys credit. You're nicer. You didn't beat us as bad as New Zealand did. New Zealand trounced us. You guys, we got a little bit closer to you guys with scores against, that sort of stuff. And I'm thinking, how can we make this better? There's got to be a way to basically combine ice, like hockey, and rugby together. And so doing some searches last night, I basically came up with this. And that's about as close as it gets for ice and rugby. But then I did a little bit further search, and I'm actually very much looking forward to this matchup right here. And then we'll see where we all land. But with that, how about we get started with a little bit of a poll and find out? Because I am curious to find out in here. This is the room, and this is the talk about iSCSI and talking about performance for iSCSI SANS. And I want to find out, first of all, who's using iSCSI, who's using other stuff. Okay, I thought you guys weren't interactive. You guys are very interactive. So what is the best business SAN or SAN for business today? A good chunk of hands went up for iSCSI, so that's good. So first off, how about Fibre Channel first? Any Fibre Channel aficionados here? So that's about 30% of the room. Not too bad, not too bad. How about iSCSI? Everybody put your hand up because you're here in the room, which is fantastic, which is awesome. fiber channel over Ethernet? Any advanced weird technology people here like this? Or maybe InfiniBand, anybody? InfiniBand? Converged cabling and stuff like that? Or how about some kind of USB stick thing put together with super fast performance and write IOs? Now, don't laugh, because you can actually, you're probably aware of this, my friend back in Canada resells this equipment. It's an iSCSI SAN coupled U device that's made entirely of SSD disks, and it has massive IO throughput that you attach up to it using iSCSI, so it's actually very, very cool. What I will say is that studies show it doesn't really matter what type of solution you're using. So before we start getting into battles about which is better, fiber channel versus iSCSI and all that sort of stuff, I want to first of all just say, if you already have made your investment in iSCSI, if you've already made your investment in fiber channel, use your investment, optimize that investment, make sure that you're using it to its maximum and you've done your research to know how to best use it and implement it and troubleshoot it and everything's good. I'm not here to try to sell you a new iSCSI solution. I'm not here to say that iSCSI is the savior of what's going on with the SAN environments. iSCSI and fiber channel have basically been leapfrogging over the years to get to the best performance to see what's going on. So again, I had some people in New Zealand that were a bit more hostile towards, well, you got to go with fiber channel and this and this and this. It's like, no. If you have it, stick with it. What you're comfortable with, this is simply looking at some other technology that's there. The reason why I'm talking a lot about iSCSI is because back in April, Microsoft released a free iSCSI target that you could install on any commodity or high-end hardware with disk attached to it, and then expose it to any iSCSI initiator. And that all of a sudden opens up this big possibility. And yes, there were other software providers that also made it as well. Starwind is one that comes to mind. And they also had an iSCSI target that's there. I'm not saying use ours versus theirs. But if you don't have access to a SAN, if you're looking to upgrade your skills, if you're looking to make some investment of your time and your career to understand how this works, this is the session for you, as well as some extra performance tuning and performance stuff that's going on too. So that iSCSI software is kind of an equalizer to get you up to understand what's going on. But this actually comes back from a little bit of a poll that took place by a company with three letters called EMC that basically said, hey, we're a SAN company, among other things. And they did a survey basically saying, hey, what is your choice for when you do virtualization? Is that your driving need for why you go off and you buy SAN? And, you know, it was an interesting survey that went out to about 350-odd individual respondents, and it came back with a very interesting finding. Is there a laser on this one? Yeah. Oh, it's green. Right here. Look at this. No. The overall resounding answer at 89%, no. I already have the infrastructure in place. I'm just using it for virtualization. There's very few, or there's less greenfield, brand new SAN where virtualization is the driver. It's normally other workloads that's the driver. Potentially, the administrator that's looking after the SAN is not the administrator that's also looking after the virtualization side. The server side, you have to go off and talk and have a parlay between them. But the reality is, it's not a driving factor. Yes, you use it if you absolutely have one, and I suggest use it from throughput perspective. I'm going to here open up your eyes to some architectural choices that'll make some very big changes to the way that you can get performance out of an iSCSI SAN in particular. We're not going to be talking about fiber channel today. We're talking about iSCSI and where that works. So, you know, iSCSI, I mentioned, has been leapfrogging the whole concept of where fiber channel is for performance and what you can do with it and different types of workloads. I guess, you know what, I would like to find out from this, from you guys, is, are you the virtualization administrator, looks after virtualization in your office in some way, shape, or form? It should be almost anybody, because almost everybody's doing virtualization these days. Now, keep your hands up for a second. You said yes, come on, this is an answer in the morning. Now, keep your hand up if you're also the SAN guy. Two hands went up all of a sudden. Not double duty, nice. Okay, not bad. So most of you are also SAN people, which is good. This is awesome. Because what I've come across is that a lot of times, the SAN people are different than the people doing Microsoft virtualization, maybe not so much so if they're doing that other company, it starts with a V and ends in where. But we'll get back to that. So why was iSCSI not really looked upon as a big performance option in the past? Well, some of its detractors come down to an architectural question. My background is as an architect before joining Microsoft for designing infrastructure solutions and designing SANs and high availability and clustering, that sort of stuff. And really, the neat thing, and also one of the detractors for iSCSI, is that there's the potential for oversubscription. And with oversubscription, that means performance issues. And we'll talk about more about bottlenecks coming up. There's also potentially some less performant workloads that sit on top of iSCSI that are very intensive for the stuff that it does. And so, again, some people prefer to go with the fiber channel as the option, or they've already made that investment. I haven't heard this one too much, but it did come up, which is rather interesting, which is more of a security issue or a security concern, because, hey, iSCSI, it's a packet. It's on a routable network. I can plug into that network and sniff it, and I can take a look at it. So potentially, there's the option of going in and, like, you know, deconstructing and figuring out what's going on with that iSCSI traffic, right? It's a lot harder to hack a beam of light that's running on fiber channel than it is to go with simply an Ethernet packet that's going on top of 10 gig E or 1 gig E. So potentially there's some detractors there for some ideas behind it. But really the benefits come down to the simplicity. It's easy to use iSCSI. It's very easy to use in the setup. As I mentioned, there's a very small download you can put onto any type of system. You got yourself your target, a couple of quick little configuration options. You can have any Windows 7 or 2008 R2 server with its initiator built in, talking to it to be able to go off and to do stuff. You can have your own live migration capable Hyper-V solution using the iSCSI target software from Microsoft up and running in a matter of half an hour or so with clustering. It's amazing the stuff you can do with it. Great for learning capabilities. Now, it also potentially is able to leverage a lot of in-house experience. Again, it's not the dark arts of understanding the light between the transmits and the receives and that sort of stuff with how things go. And then potentially, although I don't see this as really founded or not, it's going to be saving you on some cabling for where that happens to go, for some infrastructure. You can reuse some existing stuff. I'm not a big fan of the reusing, personally, just from an architecture perspective. I've got an interesting proposition for you. Do you guys believe me that it's that easy to set up an iSCSI SAN with the new Microsoft iSCSI target, that basically almost anyone can do it? Do you guys believe me? I've got one yes. Everyone else still hasn't absorbed themselves with coffee yet. Well, this link should work. Oh, it is working. How about if I show you, I need some sound on the PC here, a link. I know you have fast internet. Come on. Here we go.
Hi, this is Dennis Martin, president of DemarTech. We thought we'd have a little fun today and show you the iSCSI initiator from the viewpoint of a 10-year-old girl.
10-year-old girl.
Hi, setting up iSCSI. I'm Violet Westing here at DemarTech Labs. Today, we're going to demonstrate how easy it is to deploy iSCSI. Suppose there is a remote storage you want to access from your local computer. There are many ways to do this. iSCSI is a simple and inexpensive way to make remote storage look like a disk is attached directly to your computer. iSCSI stands for Internet Small Computer System Interface. iSCSI is a protocol to deliver block data to client computers over Ethernet. It's very flexible working over megabit and gigabit Ethernet. Today we're deploying it over wireless.
Don't do that for production.
Our storage administrator has already configured a disk array with a LUN for our use with the iSCSI initiator name of this laptop.
I want his job.
To enable iSCSI on this laptop, we access those LUNs we need to start the iSCSI initiator tool.
Okay, this is built in.
In Microsoft Windows, we can access the iSCSI initiator tool from the start menu by typing in iSCSI in the search field and selecting iSCSI initiator. From the configurations tab, you can see this computer's initiator name, which was given to our storage administrator to use to configure the remote disk for this computer to access. From the Discovery tab, we can select Discover Portal and enter the IP address of our remote storage. On the Targets tab, we can now see the iSCSI's initiator's name of the remote disk array. We activate it by clicking Connect. Choose Storage Disk Management from the menu at the left. If the LUN has not been discovered as a disk yet, select More Actions, Rescan Disks. Now that we can see the LUN as a local disk, bring it online and initialize it. format it and create a simple partition. I'm choosing to allow the new simple volume wizards to use all the defaults. The new drive is now formatting. It takes a little time over wireless Ethernet. As you can see, the iSCSI 1 appears as a local drive to this computer. I can write data, like my school work, on this flash drive and read back from it. It works the same way it would with any other local drive. I'm Violet Westing, and it's easy to deploy iSCSI. For more information, check out the DMARTech iSCSI zone at dmartech.com/iSCSI.
Now, again, I wouldn't recommend, for performance reasons, you deploy iSCSI over wireless. I don't know about the ITIL certification of that storage administrator, if he follows proper change control, but definitely very, very easy to set up. I'm going to show you a couple of quick little clips in a bit about some other things that come up when we start talking about iSCSI and performance and some configuration options there. She was actually doing that, as you saw, from a Windows 7 device. Windows 7 device has the ability to go up and attach up to the iSCSI target, obviously. It could be software-based target like that one, like the one I'm going to be talking about was, or it could be a hardware-based one from that app or whoever it happens to be. But first off, architectural-wise, here are some myths and some things that you absolutely should make sure that if you haven't already done this back in your site, you go ahead and do from a checklist of things to ensure you have the ability to use to get better performance out of this. Because usually it's a configuration issue as to why you're not getting good performance out of your iSCSI environment. So the first one is make sure that you're taking advantage of something called TCP chimney offload, where you're able to go in and basically get the TCP/IP protocol processing off of the CPU of the server and down into the NIC adapter. And obviously it was available with RTM when it came out. And sometimes it ends up having to be a licensed feature that you have to enable or purchase off of your hardware vendor. But if not, and you have the ability to turn it on, make sure you have TCP chimney offload on. It will increase your performance with having access to this because you're using TCP/IP stack to get access to your storage in the sky, right? It's pretty simple stuff. Virtual machine queue is another one, basically, where you're able to go in and take frames from your systems based on a target virtual machine. Different CPUs basically are then able to go off and load it and handle it. Now, the VQM, or the virtual machine queue, has to be supported by your network hardware as well. Usually it's an Intel NIC that does that, but other NICs are able to do it as well. It's a feature set you have to turn on with the proper drivers, making sure you have your drivers up to date on your NICs that you're using on your individual servers. Receive-side scaling is another thing you can do to be able to turn things up a little bit. Again, most server-side NICs are able to handle receive-side scaling to be able to handle load across multiple NICs and across multiple CPUs. And finally, NetDMA as well, offload some stuff to be able to make sure that you've got memory paging operations going through the dedicated DMA engine down to your servers. Now, this all applies to Server 2008 R2 systems, regardless of its server core or server full install, because that's only an install option. What happens if you have older systems talking to this as the hosts to your iSCSI solution? Well, you are able to go off and download something that's called your acceleration pack, or the scalable networking pack, that was available previously. It's built in 2008 R2 and above, and basically your NICs have to support all these individual options. And that kind of brings up some other interesting questions, which we'll talk about in just a minute, about those NICs and about different types of hardware accelerators, what you can do. But the biggest mistake that I've seen in the past for people using iSCSI is that they think it's just this big bucket in the sky they can turn on, NIC teaming, and then boom, they've got the best possible performance to get there. It's the biggest common mistake. Do not use NIC teaming with iSCSI. It is not the best thing to do. iSCSI is obviously useful in different types of production networks for different types of workloads and things, but it's a proprietary NIC driver that you have to install to make it work with the operating system to make it go. As soon as you go in down that path, you no longer have the ability to go off and to tweak a bunch of different options that you have on it. NIC teaming basically overrides and defeats the purpose of what you're doing with multipath I/O and also with MCS as well. So stay away from NIC teaming. It does not equalize SCSI teaming. We'll talk about that in just a bit. So the first off, for multipath I/O, you got two flavors. And there's what I would say is generally an older flavor with MCS, which calls multiple connections per session. Or there's the other one that seems to be more of a standard these days, which is multipath I/O or MPIO. Now, this works at the iSCSI initiator level. It's part of the iSCSI protocol, as you can see from the stack there with the operating system, down the disk driver, down to the SCSI part, down to the iSCSI initiator, and then down to TCP, and then down to individual NICs. And then MCS is able to go off from there. It does not require any direct storage device support specifically. It's all a matter of if your provider happens to give you access to this. And basically, it's very simple to install and to configure. Here's an example of what the screenshot looks like for configuring this. Now, the important part is that there's something called policies. As soon as you have multiple paths, think of it like routing packets, right? As soon as you have multiple paths, you have to choose how is that path selected to get from point A to point B, A being your servers and B being your disk. Well, there are a couple of different policies that are available. I'm not going to bother going through every single one of them that's there, but I will simply highlight some of the differences between them. The default one when you select and use MCS is that it uses round robin. Now, round robin is similar to how DNS works with round robin. So picture yourself that you've got three different paths or NICs to get off to your storage. It's going to go off and say, okay, I'm going to use this one. Next time, I'm going to use that one. Next time, I'm going to use this one. And basically just goes off and uses whichever one blindly happens to be available and go. And then if it's busy, it queues it up and off it goes. So it does give you a load balancing across multiple NICs and multiple paths to get into your storage. It's important to note the difference with MCS, in case you're not familiar, is that MCS applies to the session connection. So it's across all of your different VLANs that are there. When you use MCS, you can't change your policy on an individual VLAN basis. Another one that's kind of interesting, I never see it used though, is failover only. That's kind of stupid from a load balancing perspective because it only is used if one of them is not available. Then it goes to use the failover. Round robin with a subset or least queue depth is a bit more interesting because it's able to look into the queue and make an intelligent decision on do I go this way or that way, as opposed to simply randomly picking one from a round-robin perspective. So it has to look into the protocol stack and into the queues themselves to see what happens to be busy. Very cool. Weighted paths are for your control freaks out there. I used to be one from an exchange perspective, setting up all your different links between your systems and putting different weights on the connectors and stuff for how messages route inside your system. If you're that kind of person that likes to do that, you can, in fact, architect your solution using weighted paths. However, should your network change in any way, shape, or form, you will have to go back and revisit those to make sure that they're still applicable. Good to know from an MCS perspective. Now, multipath I/O is the other option, which seems to be more supported these days in the industry, that's there. It's not part of the iSCSI protocol. Basically, the manufacturer has to create the MPIO-enabled driver, and most storage arrays are going to have something called a device-specific module, or a DSM. Another big performance hit that some people don't look after is that the DSM has to be installed on your hosts, like a driver. And if the DSM is not up to date or updated on a regular basis as the manufacturer updates, you may end up with inconsistency, poor performance, weird packets going down the line, retries going on if you're looking at stuff. So be very careful that you keep your DSM up to date. Important to note as well, in case you didn't notice, Microsoft has its own DSM built into the operating system as part of the iSCSI initiator. Sometimes the Microsoft iSCSI initiator DSM is the priority over top of the vendor-supplied one that you install to talk to your NetApp gear or your Equalogic SAN or whatever it happens to be. Make sure that you have the proper one selected in the order of what's being used in the connection details for your iSCSI initiator, to make sure that you're using the proper one. Whenever someone comes up to me and asks me, well, I got this kind of traffic happening, it's retrying, I don't know what's going on, I said, first thing, what's your DSM like? Have you updated it recently? Have you checked to make sure it's in use? Very important. Now, a neat thing about MPIOs is it also has paths, and it also, not paths, it also has policies as well. But this applies for each individual LUN. So in theory, you could actually go through for the different LUNs that you have exposed to your systems and put in different policies. Maybe it's going to be run round robin for everything, but maybe it's going to be a least queue depth for your virtualization workload. Which one's best for you really comes down to your environment of the workload you're running and the SAN hardware that you happen to have. But if you need to have specific policies for each of your VLANs, then you are going to have MPIO as the choice. Now, about 80% of the market out there is using MPIO and no longer really using MCS all that much. And so be aware of that, MPIO seems to be the way places are going these days. Now, which way to go? Well, first off, as I mentioned, many people happen to be using MPIO as opposed to MCS, so you might not have the option. You'll see that in the iSCSI software initiator that you're going to be loading, installing, and working on your host machines. Use MPIO if you want to support different load balancing options that happen to be inside your environment. As I mentioned, on a per LUN basis, you can change up the policies. It's a very simple process to do. Hardware iSCSI, hardware acceleration cards, which is rather interesting. Does anyone actually have an HBA card for iSCSI inside their servers? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 people or so. It's a NIC. It's a specialized NIC, yes, they'll give you that. It's got some extra juju juice on top of it, but it's a NIC, right? And it's specifically designed for iSCSI hardware. So I'm not sure of the cost advantage for using it for performance based on the other one. You guys will have to do your analysis on that, but you don't have to go and run off and do this and buy your own HBAs that are iSCSI specific. Talk to the partner up with your vendor, with your storage. They might recommend some to get even better performance. Because it's all about performance to get there, right? You have a comment there, sir, quick? Pardon me? Okay, good point, yes. For the HBAs that are iSCSI based for boot from SAN, it is support on that, so good point. MPIO is also not available for XP and also not available for Vista and for Windows 7. So if you have your client running one of those OSs and you want them to talk to one of your online storage that happens to be iSCSI, you can only use MPIO. You can only use MCS. You cannot use MPIO on those individual systems. Not a big deal, but especially from a virtualization perspective, it's good to know, though, that's the case. MCS also tends to have marginally better performance, but we're talking percentages here. We're not talking tens of percentages. But potentially, on the downside, MCS does require more processing power, so there's a trade-off for the better performance that you happen to have inside your environment. Now, from a Hyper-V perspective, because that's what this session is about, is a workload that I happen to be particularly passionate about, is virtualization. For iSCSI, for Hyper-V, the best practices basically suggest using aggregation of your networks and then segregation of the traffic inside of that. Two big words that I don't really like, but, you know, it's big technical words. Aggregation is simply, again, how many lanes of traffic do I got to be able to get down to and talk to my disk in the sky through my different switches for performance reasons? And then segregation of that traffic to make sure that nothing else will impact that is the basic rule that you use for performance on your iSCSI environment. With some design considerations, this is some of the design networks that they happen to have in the iSCSI architecture documents you can take a look at. I will also point out as well, in case I haven't had a chance to do this just yet, for people that are using or that are looking at implementing iSCSI inside their environments or re-architecting their solutions or updating the architecture, each of the different SAN manufacturers and vendors have very good guidance. Like NetApp just published some great stuff on how to do Hyper-V virtualization using the NetApp solutions that are out there, so just to be aware of this. Here you got an example of the green being the storage network, the red being the production network. You got multiple connections into a single switch on a single server. It's redundant. Therefore, in case one side goes down, it's still able to function for either one of those two NICs. So they got four NICs basically in your single Hyper-V server. Nice and hunky-dory. Everything works just fine from one perspective for your first baby step for how that works. But architecturally, busting that out further is where you go in with some redundant paths and some extra layer of support. Basically, you're offloading and segregating. Sorry, you're aggregating your networks, but you're segregating your traffic with the different NICs that are involved. In this case, you've got the ability to have a different path for redundancy and also for load balancing with that dotted line there, for your storage network, and then obviously your management production network on there as well. Shared switches, you can split them up if you wanted to and go from there. But really, for a minimal cluster environment, you're looking at least three different networks. You got your storage access between two systems that have to be able to talk to the same storage. A whole bunch of traffic going across that from storage perspective. You've got the production network that they're going to be using and talking to each other and also to the clients that are accessing those systems. And then you've got this lovely little cluster network that's still in the background there to keep the heartbeats going and make sure everybody's all happy for the node majority and stuff like that. So bringing this all out to the full final development, you're looking at 2, 4, 6 different possible networks that you're going to want to have set up from an architectural perspective. Again, I'm not recommending you rip out your entire infrastructure to be able to set up an issue like this, but if you're looking to try to maximize, aggregate your traffic, separate and segregate the traffic as well, architecturally, this is the recommendation that we happen to have. You've got one small network in the background there just for heartbeats to make sure things are good from a cluster perspective. You've got your storage network with multiple paths to be able to get over to your storage from both sides, and it's only the storage traffic going across that particular Ethernet cables that happen to be running there. You got your production network for the traffic of the VMs talking off to your clients. And then the important one at the bottom is the management slash live migration network that's out there. So if you need to do a live migration between hosts, you're not going to be dumping that traffic going across your storage network. You're simply going to be doing that through a separate network at the bottom for your management side of things. Likewise as well, if your clients tend to consume too much of your available bandwidth and saturate your network link for your servers with the production access, you're not going to go off and end up saturating it, trying to manage it or move it in the future because you've got a dedicated network for it. Now, this may be an awful lot of NICs, kind of difficult to keep track of it all inside your environments that are out there. So what can you do to basically help out and to make this work a little bit better? Well, one thing that I'll mention is a friend of mine is a TSP in Microsoft over in Calgary, and he's a big NetApp. He's a Dell guy, an Ecologic guy, and he and I got together and said, okay, well let's make a couple of quick videos specifically around how to set up an ideal lab environment for your cluster of two Hyper-V nodes, an iSCSI slash hard solution, NetApp or dedicated SAN solution for your storage. How would you architecturally set that up the best, and what are some best practices for it? So for me, because I'm not terribly organized like I used to be as a consultant, remembering which NIC adapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 represents each one of those and where it plugs into and what it does was always a confusing for me. And also because the way it's exposed in the tools by the attributes that it exposes inside the tool for Hyper-V Manager or the Cluster Manager or SCVMM or whatever it happens to be, I'd always get confused for which one was what when I was doing the initial setup. And then heaven forbid if I have to move a server and remember which NIC plugs into what and stuff like that. Because I'm pretty sure you guys take probably about as good documentation as every other IT administrator that's out there, right? Come on, I know you're all the same. We're all the same like this. Okay, I've got some time here. I'm going to just quickly show you two little videos that came in quite handy for working on this. And I'm going to drag this over here so you guys can see it because I didn't embed this one. So bear with me as I make it happy. I have links to these in case you're interested, but for now I'm just going to go ahead and hit play.
The next thing that we're going to take and go through and validate is we're going to validate that we've got all of our proper drivers installed, which I've downloaded the latest HP support packs.
Just a couple of minutes
here. The server model that we have is an HP 685 C model blade server. And it's got two NICs. So the important thing to note here is that with the network configurations that we've got, is I've got a 2-port on board with 2 LOM, which is basically NIC ports. And this is going to be used for my external network, as well as my heartbeat and live migration network. The second one is a 2-port add-on card. And this is going to be used as a dedicated iSCSI multipath I/O configuration. Okay, so this is how we're going to configure it. I know what these adapters are and how I've profiled them on my server. So these two adapters are my external, and these two adapters are going to be my iSCSI. Now, a typical configuration, you might see somebody doing something like this. They might type external, they might type private, and they might type iSCSI 1 and iSCSI 2. I don't like that. Please don't do that moving forward. We're going to have a new naming convention that we're going to set up for this. And it's really, really important that you take in, that you pay attention to this section. NetApp has published a really good resource guide for configuring networking for Hyper-V. I highly suggest you download it. And we've been following a methodology similar to that for quite some time. So take a look at the differences in naming conventions here. Because this is one of the areas that people sometimes get lost and confused with Hyper-V, is just how to configure their networking
properly. I get lost
properly.
And confused a lot of times.
So the very first thing that I'm going to do here is I'm going to relabel this to something called PNIC1 or physical NIC1. This is going to be set up on port 1. I know this is on port 1 on my physical adapter. The way that Windows represents this is sometimes a little bit different. It's going to be configured for my external network. And if I have a VLAN configured for this, for example, if I'm configured on my front-facing VLAN for something like VLAN 80, I can type this in here. I'll also take this one step further, and if I'm connected to a Cisco 3750G, I'll also identify the port that I'm in. So if I'm in port 0/27, now I know exactly what switch port I'm plugged into, what VLAN, what NIC port. So if I ever have to move this box at a later point in time, I'm not going to have an issue with this. So I'm just going to leave mine like this. Because mine's a simple configuration that we're going through here. But I want you guys to seriously consider taking and using this type of a naming convention for all of your server builds moving forward. This is going to be my Heartbeat and Live Migration Network. This is going to be iSCSI. So this is my PNIC2. Port 1, iSCSI. This is PNIC 2, port 2, iSCSI. So now I know exactly where these things are going to be plugged into. This is so important that we do this. I'm just going to really quickly go and IP these servers, and I'm going to pause the videos. When I come back, I'll show you what the IP configuration I've used is.
Now, it's a small thing, but it comes in very, very handy, as opposed to trying to figure out which NIC is what and what's plugged into, and helps you keep track of which is segregated for your network. Also potentially helps if your misconfiguration options. But it kind of drives home just with this small little chunk here, which I'll see if I can get queued up correctly. This is the cluster manager software, and it also will show you the confusion of the attributes that get used.
Sure that this is actually working properly. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to navigate into my nodes, just make sure that both of my nodes
are two blades.
It looks like they both are. We won't have any services and applications just yet. It looks like my Quorum disk has been defined, and I've got two disks available for cluster shared volumes.
And then look at that, three
I've
networks.
I've got three networks
what
defined, which is exactly as I have planned, which is going to be one for iSCSI, one for Heartbeat Live Migration, and one for front-facing. So this was PNIC 1, port 1. So now you start to see why I label these things the way that I do. We can see their network interface configuration. And what we're going to do is we're just going to go relabel these now. So we're going to call this our external network.
And simplify it in here. At least now you know which NICs are doing what inside your environment. And make basically automating the documentation for what's going on to make it so you don't make any really bad design choices
should be
for where things go. In case you are interested, those are posted. There's four different videos out there. It's about, it's about 40-odd minutes of some really good stuff about architectural design, setting up a lab environment, using iSCSI for the best performance to be able to go off and do stuff for live migration. Great stuff in there to be able to share. And then come here, shift F5, and we continue. Okay. Continuing on along this, now the next obvious iteration for this, besides those multiple networks, is now also building out your infrastructure to have multiple switches so you don't have congestion on your switches. and also to have redundancy in case you happen to get a power failure in one of those switches, to be able to do this. Again, this is building out the Cadillac, the big-ass solution for your iSCSI that's out there. Now, again, the green connections are going to be multiple paths to get to your performance. Your blue is going to be just for the cluster purposes. The black is for your management and also for your live migration traffic. And then finally, also, the red for your production network. You also should be able to go in and make sure that your binding order for these different networks and your NICs are set correctly as well, with weights to be able to choose which way stuff goes for your different solutions. But then the little black box that's there saying 10 gig E, that's something that at least is warranting a discussion. I'm going to bring this up now. It used to be with virtualization, you had a single box, local attached storage, and everything's all good. You're able to go in and say, "Hi, I can take these five machines. They're running at 5% utilization. I can take the 10 of them. I can put them onto one server. And then now I'm at about 60, 70% utilization. That's great." My contention or my performance bottleneck at that point in time was more concerned from an optimization process, mostly with CPU for what's going on. And then it kind of came around the disk, that locally attached disk. Okay, so let's fix that bottleneck. We then take the disk away from being local storage and put it up onto the network. Great. It's awesome. Now I got better performance. And now all I really have to worry about is disk I.O. and I.O. traffic for the reads and writes to be able to access my spindles on my SAN or on my server that's out there. Fantastic as well. But something to be aware of is the if you don't proactively monitor what's going on those individual networks to see what the saturation levels are, you're going to just all of a sudden start to hear that your servers are slow. You don't know why the servers are slow. And it could either be, generally, it's not CPU contention anymore. Might be some RAM ceiling limits, but with Hyper-V and Service Pack 1 with dynamic memory, we can get around that sort of stuff better than the other solutions that are out there, which is good to know. But generally speaking, it either is going to be a congestion in your disk network, where you're getting too much transmits and retries and everything else that's going on that system that's causing you grief, or it's going to end up being that you have an issue with the saturation of that network just being overconsumed, oversubscribed. So picture a network for traffic up there. It's not your disk IOs anymore. It's not your memory. It's not your CPU. It's the traffic to get there. 70% utilization at 1 gig. Swap out that 1 gig switch to a 10 gig E switch and 10 gig E iSCSI cards. You can almost literally take the decimal point from the 70% and move it down to 7% utilization. Call it 10. When you start going with 10 gig E. So you got this massive amount of bandwidth all of a sudden to get back to your disk to prevent the contention for what goes on, for the nature of how Ethernet works to go off and talk to those switches. So 10 gig E is an investment. It's an area to look at. If you were going to buy stuff to be able to improve your environment right now, a 10 gig E solution might be the way to go. 10 gig E switch network cards might have been installed in your servers already. They just aren't being used just yet. But it is going to be a cost involved to be able to have to look at that as an option. Now, going past the solution from just talking about iSCSI for just a minute here, what about your disk configuration on your iSCSI targets? Well, it used to be fixed VHDs was the absolute no-brainer way to go. If you had a fixed VHD installed, perfectly expanded, nicely installed on your iSCSI solution, you then attach up to it, you're binding to it, everything's all good. In the days when Server 2008 came out, you had about 96% of native performance that was out there. Nowadays, it literally is negligible. It's equal to native if you happen to have disk that's attached. So definitely, that is one option. Downside is, it takes up a lot of space. Well, pass-through disks was always equal to native as an option, and some people still subscribe to using this for different workloads. The downside of a pass-through disk is that it ends up requiring more configuration from a... if I need to add more storage into it, or if I remove more storage to it, into it, it gets to be a bit more complex. But performance-wise, it's basically almost equal to native. Dynamic VHDs used to be a huge no-no in when 2008 came out. It got a lot better with 2008 R2 and also Service Pack 1 on for performance. But you're still going to take about a 15 to a 5% hit. And so you may not be willing to have that kind of trade-off for performance just to be able to save some space as it dynamically expands. Personally, I'm a bit of a purist. I prefer the fixed VHD because I'm old school. However, dynamic VHDs or dynamically expanding VHDs are not that bad for performance these days compared to where they used to be. Now, another option which could be useful, although not necessarily the norm, which I'll talk about in just a minute, is the ability to actually go through and have the guest directly attach up to the iSCSI itself from a performance perspective, as opposed to going through the VHD solution. So VHDs that are generally fixed tend to be the most in use. Pass-through, not necessarily required for optimal performance these days. However, it does do good for things like specific backup and recovery agents and software specific to your SAN to be able to take advantage of, obviously. It's also great for very, very large volumes to have to be able to go ahead and create on disk is much more natural than having to do it within the configuration of a VHD environment. Potentially, there's some app compat requirements that are out there as well. So you need to choose which one makes the most sense for your bigger workloads. However, if you haven't explored VHDs, you just automatically wrote them out, off, fixed VHDs are definitely a viable option for you. Now, this fourth option I was talking about is going with iSCSI Direct, where basically the VM attaches directly up to your iSCSI using its iSCSI initiator. The Hyper-V host has no idea this connection is going on or care that this network connection is going on because it's going through the VM bus and out the network stack, right? The VMLUN is not visible to the Hyper-V host. The VMLUNs, interestingly enough, can be hot added and removed because it's iSCSI, right? You can automatically add these systems in to your environment because it's simply a software add, where you can't do that with a pass-through disk and you can't do that with a VHD file. So definitely an option. It also allows you to do guest clustering as well if you wanted to. So you could cluster your host and also cluster your guests with an iSCSI Direct going through. Very interesting options. The only concern comes down, obviously, degradation performance potentially, and also some of those accelerations that we talked about at the NIC layer are not going to work for you because it doesn't go through the NIC layer. It actually will be going through the network layer for production networks unless you route your networks differently for how this works. It gets a bit complex architecture. You have to have a, you'd have to have a, just like you would for iSCSI architecture physical, you'd have to have a NIC for your production and a NIC for your iSCSI that are both virtual, one pointing to the production network in the guest and one pointing to the iSCSI network in the guest as well to be able to do it. So you have to architect your physical and architect your virtual as one option to be able to do this. Now, that DemarkTech video that I showed you earlier on with the 10-year-old girl, that's actually the daughter of the owner of DemarkTech and his son that's on that particular video. They're actually a testing lab that's gone through and made some really great resources available to you in case you want some more hard numbers about performance of going either iSCSI Direct native connection or iSCSI Direct options for performance using a bunch of different tools like JetStress and stuff like that. In this case, they did a comparison of 10 gig iSCSI performance native server versus a guest, Hyper-V guest talking iSCSI direct to the system. Basically, the IOPS differences, it's negligible. You're looking at about 12% IOs per second less with a direct connection, 2.5 milliseconds slower for DB reads on this particular, 1.5 milliseconds slower for log reads. So again, it's negligible. It's there. It's an option from a design perspective. It's not that bad of a performance hit to take a look at doing iSCSI Direct from within your guests as an option. Now, the big thing is here is, again, just pounding that server with a 10 gig environment on your servers. It's only, in this case, for this particular JetStress, just basically maxed out, is only using 37% of that pipe from a 10 gig perspective. That's basically maxed out. So you still have a lot of extra headroom to be able to handle all the rest of the traffic, even if your exchange server is just beating the snot out of that network for the workload that you happen to have. So good to know from a 10 gig investment perspective, although there are is obviously cost. This is an interesting question that came up in New Zealand from a guy that came down and talked to me afterwards. He was saying, I got this really weird performance. I got this IBM stuff running in the background. For some reason, I'm not getting some great performance. When I'm taking a look at my packets, I see these retries and retries and retransmits and retransmits. Basically, performance would go up and then down, up and then down, up and then down. And basically, it was jumbo frames that was going on. Jumbo frames is an option to turn on. The issue that you have is it allows larger packet sizes, obviously. But you have to make sure that every single adapter on the row to get to your storage, including your storage solution, supports jumbo frames. Every single switch supports jumbo frames, and everything else is all working correctly. What his issue was is that the default size for jumbo frames on the server was different than it was on the switch and on the NIC that was on the other end. And because it was different sizes, it was causing retransmits. So just make sure that everything's aligned, as well as also having the sizes set correctly for jumbo frame work. Because if one of those little pieces is out of whack, it's going to throw your performance out the door. So 10 gig E definitely is increasing the, in adoption-wise. It's an option to look at if you need to make a new greenfield investment. Again, I'm not going to recommend you guys go off and sink all your cash in 10 gig E as being the big solution in the world if you already have your investment already made. But basically, virtualization is a big driver. Virtualization is one of the biggest workloads talking to SANs these days that are out there because of the importance of virtualization and also, by extension, private cloud stuff that happens to be going up there. It's no longer a conversation about IOs per second that is worrying about how fast you can access those spindles. Your contention in your traffic problems is not your memory, it's not your CPU, it's turning out to be more the pathways to get to your disk that's becoming the problem. 10 gig E tends to be a bit more standard on some other boards these days, starting to come out for the newer server racks and different SKUs that are out there. Definitely a way to take a look at your individual systems, for sure. Click. There you go. So that resource I mentioned to you, demartech.com/iSCSI is where they have all their publicly accessible documents. You don't have to watch the little 10-year-old girl doing the iSCSI SAN thing again if you don't want to, although it is funny. They actually have an outtakes version of that that she has up there from some things, and I could give her some acting coaches about how to sound more natural when she talks, I guess, but definitely a good honor for doing that. It's a bit of fun to see how easy it was. Now, also on the Demartech iSCSI zone, they happen to have some deployment guides for 2011, basically talking about how they've done their tests to talk about the best way to deploy this. Don't forget, it is specific to your vendor of choice. It's a protocol that lots of vendors use. Most are implementing the same types of technologies as multipath IOs, but it's important for you to understand architecturally is your biggest factor for getting better performance, designing it right from the start or fixing what you got. And then when you start to look at optimizing that, make sure you take advantage of the stuff that's, jumbo frames if you wanted to, TCP offloads, all the stuff that happens at the TCP IP layer, and not just automatically assume turning on NIC teaming is going to get me better performance on my individual systems. So final thoughts, 2008 R2 basically adds you some very powerful and very easily accessible technology. If you're not the SAN administrator, so the 30% of the people in the room that did not raise their hand, and you've never seen the SAN stuff before, and your interest in virtualization, invest time in understanding how iSCSI works. It's really quite simple to set up. Literally, as I mentioned, a commodity PC if you wanted to, just to get started, iSCSI Target installed on that, and then have a couple of other commodity PCs with Hyper-V on it, talking to it with their initiators. You've got a cluster. You've got virtualization. You have the ability to go off and do stuff. And it's actually supported from a Microsoft perspective when it's properly working with the system. So it is supported from a performance perspective. It does work. If you call up support, we're not going to tell you to go off and to redo it again. Looking at my time that I've got, I do have to say thank you very much for listening. You guys have been great. I'm going to have about 5 minutes for questions, but I came a long way from Canada to come down and talk to you guys. I really appreciate you taking the time. Technology in Australia is amazing me all the time, for breakfast even. This is amazing. You guys seen this thing? It's a little tomato sauce or tomato dispenser. A little bubble on the top up there. Jeff Alexander said, I'm like, I need some ketchup for my egg thing. And he's like, oh, it's right over there. Get some sauce. I'm like, okay. I need some ketchup? No, sauce. I grab this and I'm sitting there trying to open this damn thing up and it's not working. And he's like, no. Just turn it over and go like this. I'm like, no way I'm doing that. It's going to get ketchup all over me, whatever it is. No. It's designed that way. So I'm taking this back to Canada. I'm hoping the biohazard people will let me through the country with it, because I'm importing this patent into Canada for sure. So thank you very much. I'm going to take some Q&A from you guys. I got about 5 minutes. If you could, please, evaluations. They're very important. We talked about them yesterday during the opening session and the keynote. It's how we basically go off and know how to do better. So I'd love to know what I could do better to improve the session and also improve as a speaker. I had a lot of fun talking with you guys. We got about 5 minutes for some Q&A. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Questions and observations about 5 minutes before we wrap up. Deathly silence. Okay, well, any question at all? I have a prize. Nobody? Oh, up at the back.
Have you seen the Stanley Cup?
Have I what?
Seen the Stanley Cup.
Have I seen the Stanley Cup? Yes, I've actually, as a Canadian citizen, it is your right to go to the Canadian Hockey Hall of Fame, and you can place your hand on the Stanley Cup if you wanted to and take your picture with it. So that is an option. And for that, my friend, what's your name?
Tony.
Tony? Fresh Canadian maple syrup right here for you, buddy. Come on down. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, everybody.